Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves, presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 tattered cover gift certificate. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tire Cover Bookstore. We'd like to thank you for supporting your local independent booksellers. We are pleased tonight to present David and Nick Sheff, father and son who have both written memoirs about Nick's harrowing experience with drug addiction. David's New York Times number one bestseller, Beautiful Boy, grew out of a magazine article he wrote for which he got an award from the APA for outstanding contribution to advancing the understanding of addiction. David is the author of three other books and has written for the New York Times, Rolling Stones, and Wired, just to name a few. Nick started writing Tweak after an editor who knew David found out that Nick was a writer as well and expressed interest in hearing Nick's side of the story. Nick has been published in Newsweek, Nerve, and the San Francisco Chronicle. Tweak is his first book. Please join me in a warm welcome for David and Nick Sheff.
Thank you. Well, thanks for coming, and it's awesome to be here. I was hanging out in the bookstore today a couple times, and it's my ideal living room. I want to move in here with those beautiful couches and all those books, and it's heaven. Nick and I wrote books that came out this year, and they're both memoirs. And they, we publish memoirs at a time when memoirs have been, there's been a controversies around them because so many memoirs have come out in the last year or two that turned out to be fiction, not memoirs at all. When these books came out, one of the first questions we were asked wherever we went was, are they true? The answer to that for me is that, I wish they weren't true because our books were written about, the 5 or 6 years in the life of our family that were, there's no other way to say it other than that they were a nightmare. And we barely survived them. I'll just to tell you a little bit of the background. Nick was born in 1982. His mom and I lived in Berkeley, and we were just so excited about becoming parents, and did what new parents do. We got his room all ready and painted it, and bought the perfect crib, and went on Consumer Reports and found the best car seat and stroller and snuggly pack and all that kind of stuff. And then, Nick was born and it really changed everything about our lives. Nick really was and is my beautiful boy. And he, just brought so much joy to my life and really changed everything about my life, changed who we hung out with and the way I spent my days that were so, focused on him. And he was sort of this bright-eyed, lovely, loving child. And, I am his father talking, but he really was. And, he was, playful and sort of, it was just an American child's life. I mean, we went to parks and zoos and the beach a lot and took our trips to Disneyland. And, Nick had his own unique style. When he went to kindergarten, he insisted for a period of time on wearing tights. And all the kids teased him and said, only girls wear tights. And he said, Superman wears tights. And so he was very independent and sort of had a strong sense of self, and I was proud of him for all that. As he grew older, I was aware, as every parent is now, that our kids are growing up in a time that is very complicated, and there are many, many things that are challenging for parents and for children as they're growing up to navigate. And one of the things that is one of the biggest issues, and I know this from our experience and from the experience of so many other people, is that we have to navigate in a world where drugs are just everywhere. Jasper, my middle son, Jasper, Nick's little brother, just started high school. He's a freshman. And he came home after the first day and said, everybody smokes pot. And then I said, come on, not everyone smokes pot. And he said, well, everyone who's cool smokes pot. And, you know, it's there. And we knew it was there. And we knew that we were going to have to deal with it. And, you know, the experts tell us to talk to our children early and often about drugs. And we did that. And I did that. And I had many conversations with Nick. And I thought that, you know, I thought that those conversations actually would have an impact, and maybe more than the conversations, our relationship would, because we were very close. And I mean, that was a sort of a difference, I think, between another generational thing is, you know, we had different kinds of conversations with our children and different kinds of openness. You know, I had also had experiences growing up that showed me, first, you know, I understood drugs. I mean, I understood, first of all, the seduction of drugs, and I understood why children, you know, not just children, why people try them, you know, because I did. I used drugs growing up, many drugs. And, you know, it was all about, I mean, I understood sort of the peer pressure stuff, and I understood the social pressures, and I understood just how they could sort of make us, you know, make life a little bit easier when it, you know, especially as a high school student when I sort of felt so out of it and so awkward. And, but I also learned, you know, quickly that the warnings that they gave us that I looked at as being sort of, you know, sort of hollow and sort of scare tactics weren't scare tactics. And I saw drugs take down some of the closest people to me. As I was growing up in high school, you know, kids got burned out, kids got in trouble, kids, you know, did really, you know, some sort of dangerous things, wound up in the emergency room. And then when I got in college, my roommate, who sort of was my idol, I'd never met anyone like him. He was this bigger than life, really exciting, fabulous person, who, you know, he impressed me with everything about him, including his ability to drink and take drugs. I thought, you know, at the time that it was, you know, so he was just so much cooler than I was and so much more hardcore than I was. And I sort of, he was kind of like Keith Richard or, you know, or Keith Moon or somebody, you know, who in my mind, and, you know, we'd go out on at night and go to some party or something and go to end up at someone's house. And, you know, at about midnight, I would be very aware that I had to get up in the morning for class. And so I'd tell him I was going home, and he'd look at me like I was out of my mind and said, you know, because he was just getting started. He was just feeling okay. And sometimes then I would go home and I wouldn't see him for a day or two or three. And again, I kind of thought I admired that until, you know, I understood. And now I understood that, you know, he was the first person I knew who was a drug addict, you know, whose drug use ended up taking over his life, defining his life, and ended up actually taking his life. He died of an overdose of heroin and cocaine. So when I had those conversations with Nick, I thought, you know, I had some credibility, or I would have some credibility with him, because it wasn't like my parents when they warned me and they really didn't know what they were talking about. You know, I did know what I was talking about, and I told him about my friends. And so I thought he would listen to me, and I thought also, as I said, that I would know what was going on. And so, you know, one day when I was, he was in junior high, and I was looking in his backpack to try to, I don't know, I was looking for a sweater for him, and I found a bag of pot, and I was stunned, and I was so sad about it, because I felt, you know, one of the things was that he just seemed so young at 12 years old. And the other thing was I thought I would know, because we did have a close, open relationship, and we had all those conversations, but I didn't have a clue, and I was completely blindsided, and I was completely shocked, and I was horrified as much by the fact that I didn't know what was going on with him as I was by finding the pot. And I was concerned enough. I mean, on one hand, I was able to minimize it because I know that drugs are out there, and I know that lots of kids smoke pot, and I shouldn't have even been surprised when Nick tried pot at 12, because, you know, since then I've been studying this stuff, and I know that it's certainly not uncommon. But I was worried enough that I went in to talk to his teacher about it, and his teacher said to me, so I guess what I wanted to hear, and it was the first time that I was in a conversation with a teacher or a counselor or, you know, somebody who supposedly was in a position of some authority to tell me you know, that yes, it's out there. Yes, it's a temptation. Yes, kids are using pot and drinking, but you know, basically he told me not to worry. He said, Nick's great. He's a great kid. He's got a lot of friends. He's a good student. He's really engaged. He's sort of so engaged in the class that he kind of inspires other kids. And he'll be fine. But his drug use escalated, and it got worse throughout high school, and I still was deluded. I still was in denial because of two parallel courses that he was on, and one of them was this troubling escalating drug use, and then the other one was the fact that he still did okay, so it sort of didn't make sense to me. I mean, if he was in trouble, you know, maybe if he'd been, you know, flunking out of school, or if he'd been you know, getting in trouble at school or getting in trouble, you know, with the police or anything like that, it would have been a very clear sign to me that something was wrong. But he was using drugs and he was partying and he was doing all that stuff. But in the meantime, he still was getting, you know, really good grades. And he'd applied to colleges and he got into, you know, good colleges. And he was bound for, you know, by then time he was bound for, you know, Berkeley in the fall. And he was, you know, this great athlete in the varsity team. And he worked on this school newspaper. So there were these two things going on in it. You know, looking back, I realized that I was, I was in enormous denial. And as Nick later wrote, you know, even at this time when I was pretending that everything was okay, you know, in Tweak he said that his drug use had escalated to the point that he said it was like being in a car with the gas pedal slammed down to the floor and nothing to do but hold on and pretend to have some semblance of control. But control was something I'd lost a long time ago. I didn't understand what was happening until I could no longer pretend that everything was going to be all right. And that happened when Nick disappeared one night. And any parent who's been through this, who has you know, looked up at the clock and realized that you know, suddenly it's midnight and their child was supposed to be home at 11 or whatever it was, you know, and then it's 1 o'clock and then it's 2 o'clock. I mean, I don't have to tell you what it feels like. And I think unless you're a parent who's been through that, I don't know if you can understand it, but it is terrifying. It is overwhelming. It is, you know, I wasn't asleep. My wife was, Karen was asleep, and woke up and found me there. And when she learned Nick wasn't there, she was as concerned as I was. And we just kept saying to each other, you know, where could he be? And so after a few hours, I started calling, and I called his friends, and I called his friends' parents. And then I thought, well, maybe there's been an accident. So I called the local police department, and you know, no one, there was no sign of him. And then I called the hospital emergency room nearby, and there was no sign of him there. And so we spent this ghastly night, and there was no sign of Nick. And in the morning, Jasper and Daisy, you know, our littler children, woke up. And they came in sort of all perky and bright-eyed and ready to, you know, start the day, and saw us, their parents, sitting there, you know, in sort of fit to be tied. I mean, out of our minds with worry, and they looked up at us, and you know, and you know, that became sort of this nightmare for our family. And it didn't end there. You know, Nick at that time was gone for about 3 days, and so there were 3 days of that anguish. All of us were just so worried about him and so baffled by what was going on. And I made those phone calls over and over again. And one of the times I called the police after the second or so day, the person who answered the phone at our local police station said to me, well, Mr. Chef, have you tried the morgue? And I hadn't, but you know, that was my next phone call. Finally, Nick did call, and it was after maybe 4 days. And he sounded terrible, and he told me where he was, and he said he was in trouble, and I went to get him, and he looked terrible. I mean, he looked near death. He was emaciated and bruised, and his eyes had this, you know, terrible sort of blank stare, and he just could barely move. He was trembling, and I kind of helped him get up, and he just felt so brittle that he could break. And I helped him get in the car, and I said to him, you know, Nick, are in trouble. You know, we've got to figure this out. We've got to get some help. And he said, I know, Dad. And I got him in the car and drove home, put him to bed, and he passed out. And I got on the phone and began to understand then that, you know, what we call in this country a healthcare system, you know, a mental healthcare system, is a disaster. I mean, it's almost non-existent. I mean, I was in the worst state possible to try to be making a decision about something as important as where to send my son to be treated. And then I made these phone calls and got just, you know, everyone I talked to had something different to tell me. You know, somebody said to me, or not just somebody, people said to me, you have to kick him out of the house. It's the only thing that will help. People said to me, don't let him out of your sight. And, you know, he was this, you know, 18, 19-year-old kid. You know, how do you, you know, sort of wrestle a child of that age? I mean, somebody said, you know, you have to send him, they told me about this place that was good for teenage kids that had helped troubled teenage kids. And I called them up, and when I told them about Nick, they said, well, how old is he? And I told them that he was 18, and they said, well, he's too old for our program, and they gave me the name of someplace else that might be good for him. And I called that place, and when I told them he was 18, they said, well, he's too young for our program. And so I made phone call after phone call after phone call, and basically knew that I had to figure something out. So I talked to a parent who had a child who'd been in a similar situation and told me about a place that had helped her son. And so I called them up. They took our insurance and had a bed. And so I packed Nick up and woke him up and said, you know, it's time to go. He looked at me like I was out of my mind. You know, go where? I said, well, you know, we're going to go get you some help. And he said, no. I said, we found this place. They deal with kids who are, you know, addicted to drugs. And he said, I'm not addicted to drugs. You know, I was stupid. I'll never do that again. And I said, do what again? And he said, and that was the first time he said that he was using crystal meth. And I had learned by then, by the phone calls that I'd made, that, you know, if Nick had been under 18, I could have made the decision for him. I could have, you know, put him in the car and driven him someplace and checked him in. But once a child turns 18, he had to decide, or he had to walk into a place himself. He had to sign the admission papers, and he was completely, utterly unwilling to even consider that. And I pled with him. I threatened him. I bribed him. I did everything I could to get him to agree to go. You know, Nick, you almost died. What is it going to take? And finally, I was pushing so hard that his answer was to leave again, and he left again. He was on the streets again. He was gone again. I didn't know where he was. And this was a pattern that really defined the next 5 or 6 years of our lives. Finally, he did go into treatment. He got in more trouble. He ended up in worse shape than he was the first time I went to find him. He called again. And he was ready to go in to a place. And so I brought him to a treatment center, dropped him off, was still unsure if he even need, if this was what was right for him. You know, I still looked at Nick as this sort of my you know, little boy, my child, and I brought him to this place. So when Nick said, you know, I'm not a drug addict, I mean, I didn't think of him as a drug addict. The other people who were sitting around, you know, as I dropped him off at this place, they looked like drug addicts. I mean, and if Nick... Yeah, part of me thought he's going to learn how to be a drug addict. He'll, you know, make the best connections he's ever had in his life here to buy drugs. But I also didn't know what else to do. I dropped him off, and I left him there feeling oddly that I'd sort of betrayed him and sort of fed him to the wolves in one way. But on the other hand, you know, I also felt enormous relief because I knew where he was. And that night I slept through the night for the first time in a long time. I picked him up. You know, 28 days later, it was a 28-day program. And though it had been traumatic, I picked him up and I thought, thank God we've dealt with this. You know, Nick is cured. He's gone through the treatment. This, you know, drug addiction thing is going to be over, and Nick will go on with his life. He'll head off to college in the fall as we had planned. But that's not the way it worked. I mean, sometimes I do hear stories of people who go into treatment once and they're fine. But I hear more stories about people who, for whom it takes, you know, treatment after treatment after treatment. And the hopeful thing about that is that, you know, they do go into treatment. The terrifying thing about that is every time they relapse, it's life-threatening. And so when Nick would relapse, every time I was back at that same place that I was at the beginning, and it was this anguish, this terror After going through rehab, coming out of rehab, sort of being committed to staying sober, really starting to understand that he had this problem, that he had this illness, and that he had to do what they told him in these places and work the 12 steps and see a counselor, do all the things that he learned that he needed to do to stay sober, there was sort of hope. And then there would be this devastating relapse. But finally, after about, I guess it was 4 of these programs, he came out and he really seemed to get it. And he was doing so well. And he had turned 21 that year. And I thought, you know, when any of our children turn 21, I mean, that's a big deal for a parent, you know, celebrate this milestone in their lives. And I did celebrate that when Nick turned 21. But when he reached his first year sober, you know, forget about turning 21. This year, this anniversary is what meant everything to me, because it felt that things were going to be okay, that he was going to be okay. So he reached this milestone, this year anniversary of sobriety. He went on to, you know, 13 months, 14 months, 15 months, 16 months. And it had, I never intended to learn about anything about this subject, about drug addiction, about drugs, about methamphetamine in particular. But, you know, I did. I learned a lot about it. And I'm a journalist. And I write about all kinds of things, and so I felt that there was a story to be told here, in a way, that story that had to be told, because I didn't want other people to be blindsided like I was. And I know, I knew from going into all these rehabs that, you know, everyone had the same story, and everyone was in the same state when it hit their family. They didn't know what to do. And they also weren't prepared for the way that it takes over a family and the way that a family is traumatized. I mean, every one of us, Karen and me and our littler children. And so I realized there was something to say about that. And there also was something to say about this new drug. I mean, I don't have to tell anyone here in Colorado about methamphetamine. But at the time, we hadn't heard about it. The conversations, you know, were, I mean, there were the warnings about crystal, I mean, about crack and heroin and cocaine and other drugs, but crystal meth just wasn't on our radar. You know, it was thought of as a sort of a drug that it was out in the sort of the hinterland, motorcycle gangs or whatever. But, you know, I learned the hard way that meth had you know, hit basically now. You know, it's in every city, every small town. It's devastated. You know, I just read something that in some places in America that 90 to even 100% of the crime in some cities is related to methamphetamine. So, you know, there was also something that I felt that was important for people to know about. This new drug that was sort of sweeping, or this old drug that was sort of reemerged and was sweeping through the country. And I also learned from the research that I'd done that it is, if not the hardest, one of the hardest drugs to treat, because it does enormous damage to the neurological system of users. So anyway, I talked to Nick about it, how he felt about writing about if I were to go ahead and write a story like this, because that was my first concern. I wanted to protect him but he was, you know, very bravely sort of very encouraging, and said to me, you know, he thought it was would be a useful thing to do, I think, both for me, from sort of my process of dealing with this whole thing, and also possibly it would help other people. And so I went forward and I wrote this story that came out in the New York Times Magazine. And when it came out, I sort of braced myself, because I didn't know how people would react, because I was revealing these things that I had initially kept a secret, and that many, many people keep a secret. You know, I thought, I didn't tell anybody when this started. I thought that, you know, what would people think of me, that my son was a drug addict? And I also maybe even more thought about, what would people think of my son? What would people think of Nick? So I wrote this article, braced myself, and was unprepared for what happened. It opened up a door to a world that I had a glimpse of through these very various family groups at rehabs, but it still hadn't sunk in. I still didn't understand the way that drugs, drug abuse, drug addiction is just devastating so many of us, so many of our families. And I heard from, you know, so many people. I heard from parents who were in similar situations to the one that I'd been in. I heard from children who grew up with alcoholic or addicted parents who said that, you know, this was a secret that they had never told anyone about. Even their best friends didn't know about it. I heard about, you know, from, you know, husbands who said their wives were addicted, wives who said their husbands were addicted, partners, you know, aunts, uncles, friends, best friends, everybody. And everyone, you know, sort of so many people seemed to be so desperate to be part of a conversation, to talk about this, to understand, first of all, that they were not alone, and to look for some way through this you know, dark, terrifying place that we go when this hits. And so, you know, I wasn't ready to let go of this, and I was working on a business book at the time, and so I talked to my editor about continuing to write about methamphetamine, about write about our family story, and he encouraged me, and I went forward and wrote, you know, over the course of the next year or so, I wrote the book that became Beautiful Boy. And I was so hopeful at the time because Nick had celebrated his 18-month sober. I knew by then that addiction is, at least they tell us, it's a chronic illness, which means it doesn't go away, which means that you know, it is something that someone afflicted with the illness must treat their whole life, or it will flare up, it will take over, there will be relapse, and it will progress. But still, you know, as a parent, I couldn't help but feel that, thank God, this is behind us, probably. I mean, I wasn't quite as naive as I'd been earlier, but I thought, you know, Nick is doing so well, and everything was going to be fine. And then Nick disappeared again. I'm going to read a very brief section of my book from that time, and then I'll introduce Nick. So it's morning of the third day since Nick disappeared. After French toast, Daisy and Jasper play in their room for a while, and though it's drizzling, head outside. By the time I corral them, we're running late. We'd better get them going, or they'll be late for school. They race through the house, collecting homework and cleats, stuffing them into their backpacks. Karen takes on Daisy's tangled braids and heads out to drive them to school. When they're gone, I'm left to fall apart again. Where is Nick? I'll not accept the most likely answer, that he's relapsed. He's been doing so well. It's not perfect, but he has good friends, a good job. He's biking and riding, attends AA meetings. Overall, he seems so enthusiastic about life. I know sometimes he's lonely, but who isn't? Sometimes he's down, but who isn't? Sometimes he feels overwhelmed, but who doesn't? Again, I call the police. Again, I call hospital emergency rooms, asking if he's in jail or if there's been an accident. Each time, I brace myself for the unthinkable. I rehearse the conversation, the stolid, disembodied voice that tells me my son is dead. I try to keep it together, to appear all right in front of Jasper and Daisy. They're only 7 and 9. I don't want to tell them about Nick until we know more. What will we say? Your brother's vanished again. He may have relapsed again. We don't know. But soon, we'll have to say something. We can't for much longer conceal the anguish and hysteria that once again is taking over our home. Utter despondency is followed by a frantic impulse to do something, anything. I'm desperate to find him, even though I know better. I tell Karen. She shakes her head. It won't help him. It won't help to find him if he doesn't want to be found, she says. She looks at me with concern and, what is it, exasperation, sorrow. You'll just be disappointed. I say I know, and I don't say anything more, even as my brain calculates. It won't help him if he doesn't want to be found, but he could die, and then it'll be too late. Karen wakes up in the middle of the night, finds me in the living room staring into the flames of the fireplace. I confide that I can't sleep. All I can think about is Nick on the San Francisco streets. She says, I know. It's all I can think about, too. And for the first time in a while, we cry together. And then she looks up at me and says, go ahead. Look for him. Maybe you'll feel better for trying. So on this cool, overcast morning, knowing I'm on a fool's errand, I drive across the Golden Gate Bridge with plans to scour San Francisco's Hate and Mission districts, the neighborhoods where I suspect he might show up. After driving aimlessly through the Mission. I cross town, park on Ashbury, walk down Haight Street. I duck into Amoeba, the record store, peek into cafes and bookstores. Runaways, dyed hair tattooed, tie-dyed, track-marked, stoned, hang out in doorways. The street kids still cling to the fantasy of the Haight Ashbury, but it's no longer about peace and love, Nick once observed. It's about general laziness, punk music, and drugs. If you subscribe to the idea that addiction is a disease, it's startling to see how many of these children, paranoid, anxious, bruised, tremulous, withered, in some cases psychotic, they're slowly ill, slowly dying. We'd never allow such a scene if these kids had any other disease. They'd be in a hospital, not in the streets. Of course, I don't find him. I drive home without Nick. Driving, I torment myself with the same unanswerable questions. Did I spoil him? What did I do wrong? Was I too lenient? Did I give him too little attention? Too much? If only I myself had never used drugs. If only his mother and I had stayed together. Guilt and self-blame and regret are typical responses of parents. They may serve a function as a turbocharger of conscience, but in excess they're useless and incapacitating. Yet I can't silence them. Where is Nick? I can't take this any longer, and yet every time I think I can't take any more, I do. Now I'd like to introduce you to Nick, who is, you know, my hero. I'm so proud of him, not just for his beautiful writing and for his openness and honesty in ways that, you know, have moved and helped me so much. And also, I know from what I've heard, have moved and helped so many other people. But also the way that he has taken on this, you know, this illness that he has. I know how hard it is, and he struggles with it every day, as anyone else facing drug addiction knows. So here's Nick. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Nick. I guess I'll just tell y'all a little bit about how, like, the book came together and everything. For me, I don't really feel like this whole thing is about drugs that much. I mean, it is, but I think for me, it's way more about, like, sensitivity or something. I feel like just from as early as I can remember, I was just, like, really, really sensitive, you know? Like, the world seemed really overwhelming to me and just sort of abrasive, and I just felt like I wasn't equipped to handle it. I sort of, like, think about sensitivity like one of those bell curve things, you know, you learn about, like, in high school, and, you know, on one end is, you know, being so sensitive that you just can't take it at all, and you kill yourself, you know, and on the other end is, you know, you're, I don't know, like a mass murderer or like a CEO of some corporation or something. And, you know, most people are in the middle, and I think that I am definitely way, way closer to the so sensitive that I can't take it and I'm about to kill myself side of the sensitivity spectrum. So, you know, growing up, I definitely had this feeling like there was this vacancy in me, and I think, you know, I really, like, hated myself. I felt like there was something wrong with me, and I wanted really desperately to be someone different than who I was. And when I started smoking pot when I was 12, it definitely gave me some relief from that. You know, it, like, took those feelings away a little bit, and I felt more confident, and I was able to you know, go to parties and talk to people and not feel so alone. And it was really great for me, you know, and I kept smoking, and I think in some ways it, like, you know, and allowed me to, like, get through high school and stuff. But, you know, at a certain point, I guess, I was smoking so much pot that I think that my tolerance got really high. So, you know, I mean, I definitely would like wake up in the morning and, you know, smoke a joint or take like a bong load. And then, you know, just every break I had in class, I would go and smoke. And my tolerance got so high that it really stopped like giving me that relief that it had given me before. And so I think I made a pretty like conscious effort to seek out, you know, harder drugs because I wanted that feeling again. And I tried like coke and ecstasy and acid and mushrooms and some pills and stuff. But, you know, it really was this one night where we'd been up all night doing acid, my friend and I, and he was like basically like, oh, I have some speed, you know, let's take it and then we'll feel better. And I didn't really equate the two, you know, crystal meth and speed, nor had I really ever heard that much about crystal meth, except for like, yeah, like, you know, people in the middle of the country and farms and stuff. And I did a line of it without really thinking twice, and I can say for sure that, you know, as soon as the drug hit me, it was like the feeling that I'd been missing my whole life. Like I just felt like suddenly I was complete, you know, and I was so confident and strong and focused, you know, and I just felt like I could conquer, you know, the world or whatever, and I loved it, you know, and I guess I spent, you know, the next 5 or 6 years chasing that, you know, initial feeling. So once I started doing crystal meth, like my life went downhill like super, super fast. And, you know, I ended up on the streets, you know, homeless, living in a car sometimes, living in a park sometimes. You know, I panhandled for money. I, you know, stole for money. I did things that, you know, I never ever thought that I would be doing to get money, to get high. And, you know, of course, I like destroyed every relationship that I had, and even, you know, people that I was friends with on the street. You know, we all betrayed each other, and, you know, we're really out for ourselves all the time, which is, I think, what that drug, you know, really does to people, or at least to me. But I did go, you know, into some treatment centers sometimes, you know, when I would kind of bottom out. And, you know, I didn't stay sober after them, but I think that they really did sort of help me to start to understand, like, you know, I guess I do have this, like, illness or something that when, you know, I take a substance into my body, this, like, craving opens up in me, or this, like, hunger or something. And I like can't stop, you know, and I've tried so many different things, like just, you know, drinking and just smoking pot and just taking pills and just like shooting heroin. And none of it ever worked. You know, I always just like that hunger would open up right away and I would spiral down. But I did manage, I moved to LA and I managed to get 18 months clean when I was there. And it, you know, it was mainly through working the 12-step program, like really insanely. Like I was just like practically like a, you know, fundamentalist or something about 12-step stuff. And I had a great sponsor, and he was really sweet to me. And I mean, I was like at his house like every day, and I slept over there all the time and stuff. And anyway, at a certain point, I guess, yeah, I'd had 18 months, and that article that my dad wrote, you know, came out. And like my dad was saying, or like, no, the person introducing us was saying that an editor like contacted me about maybe telling my own story. And, you know, I was really into that idea. When I was on the street and always, you know, I always was writing, you know, constantly, and I had just stacks of notebooks of trying to really tell my story. And I think it was a way of kind of like trying to have some control over what had happened and, maybe even have some distance from what had happened by making it into a story. And I also, you know, growing up, had really been affected by authors that were really, really open about sort of this dark side of themselves and these sort of perverse thoughts that they had and whatever. And, you know, I remember the first time I read, you know, like Bukowski or whatever, and I was like, I couldn't believe that someone else thought like I thought, you know, and it made me feel less crazy and less alone and stuff. So anyway, I started writing, and I kept submitting chapters, and my editor person like really liked them and stuff, which was amazing. And I got a book deal and a little bit of money, you know, more money than I'd ever seen, but, you know, not a lot, but just some. And I started to feel, you know, really confident, and I got involved with this woman that I'd been involved with for a long time, but she'd always had a boyfriend, and she was much older than me. And you know, I was living in LA, and she had all these celebrity connections and stuff, and I just was really wowed by that. And I had this feeling like, you know, if she were to love me or accept me, you know, then that must mean that I'm worth something, you know. And so I felt like if I could get her to just want me, then I would really would be able to love myself, which didn't work, of course. But so I moved in with her, and she broke up with her boyfriend, and you know, everything was great. We just like were locked in her apartment like for weeks on end. And then finally it turned out that she'd been smoking crack. She told me that she'd been smoking crack, you know, off and on, and hiding it from everybody. And you know, I decided to relapse with her. You know, I just wanted to be with her. That was the only thing that mattered to me. And you know, that led to like the, you know, definitely the worst relapse that I've ever had. We were shooting, you know, meth and coke and heroin and smoking crack, which I'd never done, and taking all these pills and stuff. And you know, I went into like convulsions a bunch of times. I had my first experience with cotton fever, which is like where when you're shooting up, you get like a little piece of the cotton in your blood, I guess, and it is like the most excruciating feeling ever. And you know, I definitely like lost everything in my life, and we just went crazy. Like, I remember my girlfriend ripping out the tiles in the bathroom and like yelling at me because she was sure I was hiding drugs in there. And you know, had this, well, I was still trying to write my book actually at the time, because I'd only finished half of it. And so I was like submitting pages to my editor, and you know, she would read it and be like, this doesn't make any sense, you know, like you need to get help or whatever. And I decided at one point in my genius that I was going to take apart the one computer I had and take apart my cell phone, and then I was going to put them together so that I could have this like amazing super computer cell phone thing, which I guess is like a BlackBerry, but I didn't have one of those. So anyway, I took apart my computer and took apart my cell phone, and I couldn't put them back together again. So I had no computer, so I couldn't keep working on my book. So I knew that my mom, who lived in LA, had a computer in her garage. So I went with my girlfriend, and I dropped her off at like a supermarket not too far from there. And I was like, you know, just hold on, I'll be right back. I'm going to go steal this computer after breaking into my mom's house. And, you know, she waited for me there, and I went and I broke into the garage, and I had this total like psychotic breakdown where I thought that, people were listening to me outside, and I was like surrounded, and I couldn't find the door, and I climbed up into the rafters and was like trying to peel my way out through the roof and stuff. And I guess, I was in there for like 6 hours or something, 'cause, you know, my girlfriend was waiting the whole time at the supermarket and freaking out. And so she called everybody, including my mom, and my mom came out and found me out there, and she had a member of the Los Angeles Police Department with her. So they gave me the, you know, the choice of either going into detox or going to jail. And I didn't want to go to detox at all. I just wanted to be with my girlfriend and keep doing what I was doing. And but I you know, decided to go because I didn't want to go to jail. And somehow they were saying they could implicate my girlfriend, and I really didn't want her to go to jail. So I agreed. Then I went into detox, and you know, it was like total hell. I'd been taking like a ton of Xanax and Klonopin like every day for months and months. So you get like physically addicted to that, and like you can have, well, I did have like seizures coming off of it, and I was in so much pain, and you know, my stomach was like, you know, it just was terrible. And I'd been in the detox about like 3 or 4 days, and you know, I remember the nurse coming in, and she took my blood pressure, and it was like 40 over something, like so ridiculously low, you know. And she like was like, okay, you got to get up and drink some juice or whatever. And I just was pleading with her to let me die, you know, and I really wanted to. I just wanted to just stop existing. I mean, I'd torn down everything in my life. I had nothing, not one thing did I have. And, you know, I just felt like it was impossible that I would ever have a life again. And I was ready to give up. But she forced me to go drink juice, so I did. And then the next day, my girlfriend came to visit me, and actually she was like, you know, hey, I have all this coke in the car, and my friend said we can stay at her house so the cops won't be able to find you there, and, you know, let's go. So I went to my room, and I started packing my bag, and for some reason in that moment, like, I just realized that if I went with her, that we were both going to die, you know. And, and, you know, like I said, I really wanted to die, but for some reason in that moment, there was like this little piece of me that told me, like, you know, it is possible that you can, you know, make a life for yourself. And even though that seems so impossible, you know, don't give up or whatever. And I don't know, you know, where that came from, and or anything, and I guess I don't really care because it came. And you know, I told her no, that I couldn't go with her. And amazingly, you know, 2 days later, she went into detox, and I completed detox and went off to this program. And you know, I think that was really the turning point in my life, where, you know, I really did make the decision that I wanted to live. And you know, I started really working on building a support group for myself, and, you know, learning how to, like, accept who I am and kind of, like, love myself, or, you know, whatever, as stupid as that sounds. I finished writing my book, and, you know, it came out, and it's been really amazing, that whole experience. And, you know, today, you know, I've definitely made a ton of mistakes. Even since the book's come out, I've, like, you know, had some really hard times. But you know, right now I have this really kind of amazing life. I have like 2 dogs, and you know, a really person that I'm really like in love with, and you know, just kind of have this life that I want to hold on to today. You know, and when I have been in positions of being about to throw it away again, I've been able to pull back and say, you know, I have something now that's worth fighting for, and I'm not going to let it go. And, you know, I have to be really diligent, and I have to keep up, you know, doing all the groups and stuff that I still go to. But, you know, it has gotten better, and I'm so grateful that I didn't give up. So, anyway, I'll read a portion of my book. And this was like, I had 18 months sober before. I don't know, that's like the magic number for me to mess up. But I was working at a rehab in Malibu, and I just felt like my life was like at this dead end place, and I was really miserable. And you know, I think that I wasn't on any medication at the time, which, you know, is bad news for me. And, So I decided I was gonna, you know, drive up to San Francisco and use all the money I'd saved up working at the rehab and sleep in my car and just use until I ran out of money, and then I was gonna kill myself. That was my big plan. So I drove up there, and the first day I was like copping drugs on the street, and actually this girl like that I'd like dated like for like a second in high school, just was like walking by, and she recognized me, and she was like just out of rehab also and ready to not be sober anymore. And her parents were out of town, and they had like this big mansion in this really nice part of San Francisco called Seacliff. And I moved in with her, and I thought, you know, I was so lucky. And I called her Lauren, so I guess this is how great things were with us. When it's over, I cook up a bunch of heroin and go to pick out a bottle of white wine from the refrigerator. I take it up to the kitchen and pour a large glass for myself. I'm naked and standing at the full-length window, looking out on the street below, feeling powerful. I eat an apple and bring one down for Lauren. The room is very quiet, and I call out to her, but there's no answer. When I worked at the rehab in Malibu, they made me take a CPR class at the Red Cross. I thought it was bullshit at the time, some thick-necked EMT talking too fast and asking stupid rhetorical questions. The class was maybe 3 hours long, but I guess I paid attention. I mean, I got the damn certificate. Seeing Lauren on the floor turning blue, my reaction is strange. I don't panic or anything. A calm sweeps through me. I remember the EMT. What do you say to do first? You shake them and shout, "Are you okay?" I do that. Check for a heartbeat. She's got one. Check for breathing. No on that. All right, then open the air passage, tilt the head back, and start chest compressions. I put my mouth to her cold, small lips. Breathe. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I feel her ribs and breastbone plate crack some under my weight as I push down. Her belly fills as I blow the air in. Her chest heaves. I reach over and grab the phone, dialing 911. Breathe. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 911 emergency, how can I help you? Yeah, my girlfriend just OD'd on heroin. We need an ambulance now. Breathe. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Do you know CPR? I'm doing it. Where are you located? I don't know the address. Seacliff, trace the call, will you? Breathe. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And now the panic sets in. Fuck, man, she can't die. Her skin is so transparent, and the veins are blue-blue rising beneath the surface. An ambulance is on its way, sir. I hang up. Breathe. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Check the heart. Still going. God, I say aloud, I don't believe in you, but now would be a good time to give us a goddamn miracle. Breathe. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then just like that, she gasps and jerks awake. She blinks twice and bursts into tears. I do the same thing, holding her. When I hear the sirens outside, I go out and tell the firemen and whoever that she's all right, but they come in anyway. They seem kind of pissed about the whole thing. Regulations say they gotta take her to the ER, but Lauren refuses. She's naked and we can't get her to put clothes on. She cries and cries, sounding like a sick cat or something. One of the bigger guys threatens to call the cops on us, and that gets Lauren moving. She's still way out of it, and nodding all over the place. She clings on to me, and I basically have to carry her up to the ambulance. She kisses me, but at that point, I'm just trying to get her out of there. They tell me to meet her at the UCSF hospital. I hate fucking emergency rooms, but I agree anyway. All right, that's not that.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we've been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 Tattered Cover gift certificate and learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.